the fight to preserve Florida's land and water. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime there or on iTunes. You can also stream this show live now on our Facebook page. And just ahead, a look at the battle in Tallahassee to protect the state's conservation lands. Do you think the legislature is ignoring the will of the voters? Give us a call. 549-2937. Then later, how to close that stubborn pay gap for women in the workplace. One expert gives her take. Plus, a Jacksonville icon marks 90 years. We'll take a look at the incredible history of our own Florida theater. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, accusations that the Florida legislature is ignoring the will of the voters. On issues ranging from everything like medical marijuana to solar power, education to gerrymandered districts, critics of the current legislative session in Tallahassee say the legislators are trying to foil a series of ballot initiatives passed by the state's voters. Here's one example, Amendment 1, a land and water conservation amendment overwhelmingly approved in 2014. Now, though, concern is rising that funding has been zeroed out for conservation in the state, despite Amendment 1's passage into law. So what's going on with this? Well, Jim McCarthy heads the North Florida Land Trust, and he's tracking this legislation. He joins us now by phone with his take. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. And here's our question to callers. Whether it's medical marijuana, solar power, gerrymandered legislative districts, or now this business around Amendment 1, are you concerned that the legislature is not paying attention to the will of the voters and the ballot initiatives they've passed into law? We want your calls. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. Jim McCarthy, of course, you're with the North Florida Land Trust, and you're in the business of preserving conservation lands in our area. Can you tell us what's happening now in Tallahassee and why you're concerned when it comes to the implementation of Amendment 1? That's the ballot initiative the voters passed overwhelmingly. I think the vote was over 70% a few years ago. What's happening right now with this?
Well, when you don't think it could get any worse, it does. Last year, we were very upset about the fact that they had cut back funding. You might remember that in Amendment 1, which was passed in 2014, you're absolutely right, had 75% of the vote, 75 to 25, a constitutional amendment that requires one-third of all doc stamp money, that tax that's applied to everybody who purchases real estate in the state, is allocated to the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And here we are in this year with a new proposal that literally gives no money to the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And we find that just absolutely appalling, a real insult to millions of Americans or millions of Floridians who clearly have in mind to protect their environment that we all hold very special, of course, here in Florida. And more to the point, everybody who's purchased a house in the past year, that doc stamp money has gone to Tallahassee, and a third of it should have come back. That means that we are now a donor county. We sent almost $48 million last year from the seven counties in our focus area, almost $48 million to Tallahassee that should be coming back to us in the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And here the state legislature has said, just ignored that, ignored the constitutional amendment, ignored in some cases the will and wishes of their own constituents, and have zeroed out that money.
And what explanation are you being given for this? Some lawmakers insist they're just refining the details on some of these measures.
Yeah, I understand. But refining is one thing, but zeroing it out is something totally different. What they're doing is turning their back, literally, on what the voters wanted them to do. They're diverting some of that money to a reservoir project down in the Everglades, which may or may not be a good thing. That's not, frankly, my issue. But it is not, as Representative Caldwell pointed out, he's the chairman of the Government Accountability Committee in the House. But Representative Caldwell's comments is that that's not the purpose of the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And he introduced his own bill last week, so there's a slimmer of hope that sometime, you know, that hopefully in these next few days, the House will come to its senses, literally, and decide that Senator Caldwell or Representative Caldwell was correct and allocate some money to Florida Forever. Florida's Community Trust, as you know, has been an extremely important part of Florida Forever and has funded numerous parks throughout Northeast Florida, and that too received no funding.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your thoughts about accusations the legislature currently in session is ignoring the will of the voters, whether it comes to Amendment 1 or other ballot-approved measures like, say, medical marijuana and other things? We want your calls at 549-2937. Jim McCarthy, North Florida Land Trust, explain again how this all went down when the voters approved Amendment 1. What does Amendment 1 do?
Amendment 1, we think, is very simple, and it has been subject to misinterpretation and reinterpretation, and it was very simple. It simply said that on every real estate transaction there are dock stamps, and that dock stamp money goes to Tallahassee anyway. So it's a state tax. One-third of those dock stamp monies should be allocated to the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. And it was very specific. And this year, the state legislature is not sending any of that money, currently not sending any of that money to the Land Acquisition Trust Fund. That funds a number of different projects. In fact, I'm shocked that this is happening because Senator Bradley has been leading this effort. Senator Bradley from Clay County represents a district from Clay West, and he's the leader of this. I mean, it's his bill, and I'm surprised, given his purported stance in support of environmental issues, that he just introduced this legislation and zeroed out the funding and the land acquisition. And then, in addition to that, Representative Stevenson has voted as well in the State House, and talk about another person who has been a good supporter of the environment over the years, but for some reason now has voted as well to zero out that funding.
All of this is happening, too, in the backdrop of the legislature seemingly not able to get to a budget by the time the session is supposed to conclude, correct?
That's correct. So there's a lot of last-minute wrangling. This truly is sausage being made. I mean, that's the old adage that, you know, that's how you make legislation. It's like watching sausage being made. This is a pretty ugly process, and it's incredibly important, and it's truly thwarting the will of the voters. Not only that will, but there was a recent survey done by UNF that I want to say it was in the spring of this year, that only 4% of the people that they surveyed wanted to fund environmental acquisition at a lower rate. Only 4%. So 96% still value the environment and still want to protect it, still want to fund Florida Forever.
We'll go to your calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. You know, Jim McCarthy with NFLT, North Florida Land Trust, on the line with us right now. The New York Times recently used some of its editorial page space to scold the Florida legislature, calling them obstructionist toils, trying to foil and blunt a series of ballot-approved initiatives on everything from the environment to medical marijuana, solar power, anti-gerrymandering rules affecting their own districts. And the New York Times writes, ballot initiatives can be an inefficient way to govern, but voters resort to them because elected officials will not act on issues the public cares about. And when these officials respond to the decisive voice of the people with regressive machinations, they should themselves be dealt with at the ballot box. So I don't think the Republican-led legislature in Tallahassee much cares about the New York Times editorial page, which has a liberal slant. But what about this standoff that we're seeing right now, where you've got a conservative legislature seemingly dragging its feet on a series of ballot initiatives that tend to lean more toward the progressive side of the issues here in our state. Approving medical marijuana, expanding the use of solar power, getting rid of the congressional or the legislative district boundaries that protect mainly Republicans, and then this environmental piece, which is your big issue, land and water conservation. What about all this?
It's a huge concern. As a public administration major many years ago, unfortunately, I've watched this all very closely, and while it's not our particular issue, the other issues that you refer to, it is as a former lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for years, and as a somebody who studies government and follows it, somebody who's interested in political science, somebody who's obviously studied public administration, this is just amazing. I mean, just absolutely, you couldn't dream of such a thing, that the state legislature would ignore the will of the voters, and it's incredible to me that they do so openly. On all of the issues you just mentioned, each of those initiatives went to the state legislature, were enacted into law because the voters passed a constitutional amendment. Now, whether that's the way to govern or not, it may be another issue. I mean, as a political follower, one would argue whether or not that's the right way to govern. But it's the only way to govern in this state, or it appeared to be, when we went and got Amendment 1 in 2014 and the other ballot referendums were passed, you know, in those years. And we're just finding an unrepresentative government in Tallahassee today. And you can't say it's everybody else and not my senator or not my state rep. It is, in fact, your state rep. The only state representative who has voted, for example, on funding Florida Forever, or rather voted against zeroing out Florida Forever, was Jay Fant. Representative Jay Fant was the only one who stood up. It's interesting that he's the only one also not running for re-election. And so it's becoming politics at its worst in Tallahassee, and that's a real problem, and we ought to be concerned about that across the board, no matter what your stance is, whether you're liberal or conservative. You got to be worried about the fact that your government is not representing your interest.
All right, let's go to your calls on this. 549-2937. Give us a call. Dennis at the beaches. Hey, Dennis, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. We are going to be celebrating the 240th anniversary of the Thomas Creek battle at the Seton Creek Park up on Arnold Road. And what's interesting is that land was marked to become property of a developer building houses up there north of the airport. And by the grace of God and the assistance of the North Florida Land Trust, 864 acres were preserved in a historic site where the southernmost battle of the Revolutionary War was fought, was preserved because of this land trust. And if they are not going to fund it, the bottom line is the reason they're not funding is they're being bought off by all the developers, and that's their pattern. You know, the big money interests are taking over the legislature, left, right, and sideways. And that's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. Jim.
That's really an excellent example of what we've been able to do. The North Florida Land Trust has been able to do over the years, and it was curious to me to watch the other day. A friend of Representative Stevenson posted on her webpage that she enjoyed watching Easter sunrise service at Alpine Park. And Cindy responded by saying how grateful she was for FTC money, Florida Communities Trust money, that helped buy that park. That's the same person who voted to zero out the money. I mean, there are other acquisitions that we have in this area that we need to protect, including, by the way, not only for environmental reasons, but for economic development reasons. And there's also property that we need to acquire in order to help. So this isn't just an environmentalist kind of viewpoint here. There's land around Camp Landing, around NAS Jacks, around OLF White House that needs to be preserved, too, to allow the U.S. military to exercise their mission. And so we need to acquire and conserve that to protect their mission and as well protect our citizens. And that, too, would come out of Florida Forever, conceivably. It falls under it's another problem, actually, with the decision to do away with Enterprise Florida, because the money that would be used for a match to acquire that property is also being zeroed out or eliminated when they eliminate Enterprise Florida. So this is more than just an environmental viewpoint or environmental issue. This is also a defense issue. It's a hunting issue. It's a farming issue. Senator Bradley has six farmers in his district that are currently waiting for funding on Amendment 1 that would come through the Rural and Family Lands Program. And those six families, they're all family farms, the Canaan Ranch, the Canaan Family Farm, the Land Family, Lime Lafayette, the Rainy Preserve and the South Pond properties are family-owned farms and ranches that are now classified as Tier 1 projects under the Rural and Family Lands Program. And it's a program that would help them stay in business, operate their family farms. And it would also provide younger farmers, it would provide an opportunity for younger farmers to get into the business.
Okay. And let me get to a few more calls on this. Tim on the West Side. Hi, Tim. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Jim, I just wanted to thank you for all the hard work you guys do. I think you guys are doing an outstanding job. And again, thanks for the old Spanish fort. We're glad you guys got the opportunity to get that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim. Marie on the South Side. Go ahead, Marie.
Yeah, hey, I just kind of had a general comment with regard to the Florida legislature in general. I think that at the time of this past national election, there was a real uprising of people wanting to have their voices heard for numerous reasons. And hopefully what I see is that that's carrying through to a more local level within Florida. I know that I belong to a couple of different political action groups that try to get involved with some local issues. And when we all first started meeting, there was this general consensus that nobody really thought about before. But I think the state legislature is not used to people paying attention at all. And I think that's changing. And I think that what we're trying to do is call them, write them, send postcards. You've seen, local, demonstrations on different issues. And I really think that that's going to make a difference because our voices are going to be heard in voting booths.
Thanks, Marie.
Coming off the air. Thank you. Thank you for bringing these issues to the attention of everybody here in Jackson, Melissa.
Thank you, Marie. Okay, so Jim, what about that? How is activism coming to bear on this issue in Tallahassee in the closing days of the session?
Well, I think we're making some headway. Marie hit it right on the head, the nail on the head. We do need to call, write, talk to, communicate with, and I don't know, whatever else we, in any way we can, to get something to happen at the last minute. I do agree with you that this country is very unhappy with its government. Clearly, at the federal level and becoming increasingly so at the state level. And I wonder how that will show itself and demonstrate itself in an election.
Okay, and speaking of that, here's a tweet for you from a listener. He tweets the show and says, legislators know there are no personal electoral consequences to ignoring the statewide will of the voters. Gerrymandering sees to that. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different factors. Again, I go back to my sausage comment, but what's really happening here is, yes, gerrymandering is a big part of it, and literally threats. My understanding is that the Speaker of the House, Corcoran, has told folks that you won't get a project in your district if you don't support this. We had an amendment that we were going to offer on the floor to Senator Bradley's bill, and she withdrew it because they said that they would take away a project in her district if she voted against it. I understand politics. I understand that that goes on. But in doing and operating that way, you're not following the will of the voters. It's politics before anything else. And Speaker Corcoran's a great example of it because he intends to run for governor. And so he's positioning himself, and he's also at the same time attempting to embarrass Agriculture Commissioner. Just went out of my mind.
Adam Putnam.
Right. He's attempting to, by zeroing out this money, to embarrass Adam Putnam, because the Department of Agriculture administers the Rural and Family Lands Program.
And, of course, Adam Putnam might want to run for governor.
In fact, he filed yesterday.
Yeah, he just filed. Okay, let's take one more call on this. Akhil on the west side. Go ahead, Akhil.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to find out, is it possible to set up a website, which is maybe one or two pages, that actually shows you how the legislatures have voted and what the public wanted side by side? So when it comes to election time, it's very easily available, and people can have a look, say that, should I vote for this person, even though will of the people was something else, and they voted against it, so that it's available at that time. Because I find that what happens mainly is that people are uninformed when they go to the ballot box, and they just haven't got a clue who they should be voting for or what they've done in the past. Whereas one or two pages or website, I think, would work great.
Okay. Thanks for that.
I think that's a great idea, frankly, on my end. And we can certainly do that at the North Florida Land Trust on the issues that affect us, obviously. And we'll be glad to post that.
All right. He's Jim McCarthy with the North Florida Land Trust. We'll continue to follow this. Thanks for getting on the line with us, Jim.
My pleasure. Thanks again, Melissa.
Much more still ahead on the show later. A downtown icon, the Florida Theater, marks 90 years in Jacksonville. We'll look at the celebration. But up next, how to close the pay gap for women in the workplace. One expert gives her take. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, dealing with the world's strong men. President Trump has invited Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, to the White House. Duterte is known for killing thousands of people in a crackdown on drugs. How do America's dealings with authoritarian leaders affect its future? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Radio Lab.
Take your marks!
Why do Kenyans always win all those races?
The Kenyans have done it again. One, two, and three.
And what happens to New York City's poop after it's pooped?
About 1.3 billion gallons every single day.
And why aren't kids afraid of quicksand anymore?
Well, what are you afraid of?
The alien in Pacific Rim. That would be totally more scary.
We'll have some answers on the next Radio Lab.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
On WJCT's radio reading service at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, it's 3 hours of news, op-eds, and obituaries from your local newspaper. Here's a call we received from someone who listens online.
I'm very happy to tell you that my daughter found the app for the radio reading service on my tablet. And I'm using that, and it's excellent. I enjoy all the programs.
If you're living with blindness and want to hear what's in the paper, go to wjct.org/radio reading, underwritten by Florida Eye Specialists.
Welcome back. Well, when America first put the Equal Pay Act on the books in 1963, women earned 59 cents for every dollar paid to men. Today, almost 50 years after that act became law, women are paid an average of 77 cents. For every dollar paid to a man. So the gender wage gap has narrowed, but it has by no means disappeared. And in fact, it's been virtually flat over the last decade. And that's a problem because in nearly 2/3 of families led by single mothers or two-parent homes, mothers are either the primary or the co-breadwinner. In two-parent families, with the wage gap and the loss of jobs traditionally held by men in this economy, reliance on a woman's income in the family budget is greater than ever. So what needs to happen to close this stubborn pay gap? With some ideas on that, we welcome Vicki Gunning. She's managing partner of the Dallas office of Locke Lord and co-chair of that firm's real estate and real estate finance practice. She'll be speaking on this topic today at a meeting of CREW, that's Commercial Real Estate Women, here in Jacksonville. Vicki Gunning, good to see you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And of course, you're an expert in terms of the pay gap in commercial real estate, but the findings of a study I think you did on this apply to a lot of industries as well. What did a recent study looking at the pay gap in your business find? What does it show?
Well, I'm on the international board of CREW, Commercial Real Estate Women, and one of the things our organization does is some of the premier research on women in commercial real estate. We do benchmark studies, which turn out to be very, very interesting and enlightening. We do them on the zeros and fives, so we've done them in 2005, 2010, and the latest one was 2015, which showed that there's still an average income gap between men and women of 23.3%, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Coming into the commercial real estate industry as a man or a woman, you start out the same as your entry level, but somewhere between 6 and 10 years, that gap starts widening. And then by the time you get to the C-suite, so the CEO, CFO level, it's almost to 30%. And mm-hmm. it's persisted. As you said, Melissa, it's you would think over time that this would get better, but it's persisted. Yeah. So we've done some digging and done a little more research on what's happening.
And what did you find? What are the what are the biggest barriers women think are holding them back from getting paid equally?
Well, there's several barriers. One of the most interesting one to me is that women are not getting the mentorship and sponsorship within their companies. Most gentlemen or other folks who are kind of in the majority group will usually have somebody who's taking them under their wing, and they'll, you know, sponsor them, bring them up through the organization, give them opportunities, introduce them to wonderful clients. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the women, because the men are holding most of the leadership positions, aren't getting the opportunities like that with the sponsorship.
Often a man will sponsor another younger man.
Right, right. And that's a lot of that's what they now call unconscious bias. It's, you know, your affinity is for people who are like you.
Sure.
And it's just the way your brain's wired. But to overcome it, you've actually affirmatively got to rewire your own brain to think about, you know, maybe I shouldn't take just this young guy to the fishing trip. Maybe I should bring the young woman in my organization to the fishing trip to meet these clients.
Now, this is so interesting to me, too. I think this applies to so many industries. Your study found that the majority of women you surveyed have either personally experienced or observed blatant gender bias. Women excluded from things like hunting or golf trips or other events where they could do business. That's one example. But 91% of the managers you interviewed say they have never displayed gender bias against a woman as a hirer or a manager. That's a pretty big gap between what the women say they're experiencing and what the senior leadership says they're doing.
Yes.
A big disconnect.
That's interesting. We may have an awareness issue as well there. The survey that we did had more than 1,000 respondents, and 11-something percent of them were men, so it wasn't all women in this survey, but 65% of the survey respondents did say that they'd experienced or seen gender bias, and 55% had seen gender bias in exactly what you're talking about, the fishing trips, the golf trips, things kind of outside the normal workplace. But the 91% who said they've never done it themselves.
Never. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's unconscious. You don't know you're doing it unless you really study it.
And when it's pointed out, what's the response? When you look at this data and you say, look, these are examples of implicit bias, you may not realize you're doing this, but you're doing this.
Right, right. So some examples for those of you who may not, you know, this may be new to you, unconscious or implicit bias. Some things are like what they call invisibility. If any of y'all have been in a setting as a woman or somebody else who's minority in your workplace and you had a fabulous point in the meeting, and somehow that fabulous point got completely ignored, and then later on, a man or somebody else will say the exact same point. I mean, that's
and
that happens
a lot. It's suddenly a great idea.
Suddenly, it's a great idea.
That not only has that happened to me, I think that's happened to many, many women colleagues I've worked with over the years, especially younger women
yes.
who feel that they're not listened to or taken seriously in meetings
when
they offer a good idea.
Right.
And not only this, your study also found that the majority of women in your industry believe that if employers are required to share compensation information, pay would get a lot more equitable. There's this movement around the country to make salaries open, make that transparent for this very reason. Do you think that would make a difference?
I think that makes a difference in that, you know, anytime you can have more transparency and more accountability, it makes a difference. And salaries are usually opaque in the commercial real estate industry.
Most industries.
Yeah. So, you know, you don't have a chance to kind of compare the salaries and see how you compare. I will say an interesting thing in our new white paper that we're talking about, Closing the Gap. It revealed that the London Cass School of Economics, School of Business, I think, did a study, and a lot of people think that the reason that there's a pay gap is because women are not asking for raises as often. And their study showed that actually women do ask for raises just as often as men, but they get their request 25% less of the time.
Mm-hmm. And they're penalized for
asking.
They're seen as too pushy.
Yes, yes.
Not assertive. Men are assertive, women are pushy, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you have some ideas then for tactics for recognizing bias and overcoming it. What are the solutions you put forth?
Well, for the industry leaders out there in commercial real estate, you know, we ask that, you know, if you're in a position where you can make a difference, be honest about what you're doing. Be honest about how you're hiring, how you're promoting, how you're introducing women to important clients. And how you're getting them in the relationships and giving them the complex projects. So use a pay equity study. That's a big deal that's becoming more and more prevalent in the U.S. So see what you're doing. And once you realize if you've got a pay gap, you need to put some accountability measures in effect so that your managers, when they're setting the salaries, are cognizant if they've got an issue with unconscious bias in the pay.
You also really want companies to make the mentoring and sponsorship of women a priority and get them to expand their external networks, too. That's the whole point of CRU, Commercial Real Estate Women. And you will be speaking today at the River Club on this topic. There are still a few seats available if you go to crewjacks.org. Organizations like this, professional organizations, can be a real tool for women.
Yeah, it's amazingly helpful. CRU has 10,000 members worldwide, including in the UK, where you launched last week. And that business network is invaluable. It's made a huge difference in my professional career. CRU Jacksonville is a very, very strong chapter. So any of y'all, men or women, in commercial real estate that may be interested in getting a support network to make your career very, very successful, I would suggest that you join.
It's crewjacks.org. Vicki Gunning speaking today at the River Club on Closing the Gender Pay Gap. She's visiting from Dallas, where she's the managing partner of Locke Lord. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Our parents help make us who we are, for better or worse. But how much can we understand about what shaped them? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Ford, who's written a memoir about his parents and the impact he had on their marriage when he was born relatively late in their lives. He says, entering the past is a precarious business. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Quick, give me the names of every state capital that include the word city. Come on, come on, what's the holdup? I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Do you have way too much information floating around in your head? Then NPR's Ask Me Another might just be for you. It's a whole hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Oh, and the answers are Oklahoma City, Carson City, Jefferson City, and Salt Lake City. But you knew that, right?
Sundays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Dee Dee Bridgewater, newly crowned NEA Jazz Master.
You know, it's just like all of a sudden people are saying I'm a jazz legend. I don't know what this means. I'm out here just trying to work.
With music from Songs of Freedom, a program curated by Ulysses Owens Jr.
Drive a man who made a life.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Keep on
moving with that. Welcome back. Well, May is Stroke Awareness Month. Stroke is the number one cause of disability and the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S. Now, most of us know the classic symptoms of stroke: numbness, confusion, trouble walking and talking. But a small percentage of strokes are what's called brain stem strokes. Today, some legal experts handling stroke cases join us now to tell us about a growing trend they're seeing: misdiagnosed brain stem strokes and how to recognize them. Matt Soule and Fadi Shakur, MD from the Terrell Hogan Law Firm, are national leaders in stroke litigation, and they represent victims and their families. Guys, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Morning. Good morning, Melissa.
So you're seeing more of these brain stem stroke cases. What is a brain stem stroke?
Well, we are seeing more and more of these. And in our work, we see lives that are devastated by a stroke, and brainstem strokes are some of the worst. Our goal is hopefully to educate folks so that they'll be able to recognize them and reduce the number of bad outcomes. But a brainstem stroke involves the circulation to the back of the brain, as opposed to left or right hemisphere. And that is at the top of the spinal cord, and that affects some of the most basic functions, bodily functions that a person has.
Okay, so what are some of the symptoms people should look for, Fadi, and how do they differ from a regular stroke?
So we all know about the classical symptoms of stroke. You know, has hospitals advertise it, it's on TV, weakness on one side of the body, droopy face and all that. And the brainstem, because it controls the flow of messages from the brain to the body and controls some basic functions, including digestion, breathing, heart rate, the symptoms may differ a little bit. The symptoms include nausea, vomiting, some coordination problems, which are different from the classical symptoms. And that's why a lot of times they get misdiagnosed and mistreated.
Okay, and so the misdiagnosis can be quite devastating, it sounds like. No, if they're not diagnosed correctly, chances of survival go way down, I'd assume.
Yeah, I mean, the longer a stroke is not treated, the worse the outcome is. But the reason that most people don't get appropriate stroke care is because they don't get to the hospital quickly enough. You don't have time to wait and see, is this person going to get better or not? So as soon as stroke symptoms appear, 911 needs to be called. That implements a whole series of steps that improve stroke care. Mm-hmm. Tests are run before you get to the hospital. At the hospital, you start performing tests, and then the appropriate doctor is there to treat you.
Right.
The misdiagnosis comes because they're not the classical symptoms. So you need to tell people, I'm having a stroke. I think I'm having a stroke, and get that whole stroke process in place to rule it out.
How do they treat a brainstem stroke as opposed to a classic stroke?
It's the treatment overlaps between classic and brainstem stroke. When brainstem stroke, if it's related to a clot that's interrupting the blood flow, there's the clot-busting drug called TPA, which is administered within a certain period of time for its effectiveness. Also, trained physicians can go through the grain to the artery where the blood clot is and actually physically extract that blood clot from the artery.
And these cases can be so devastating for families. You have some examples.
Some of the examples are just horrible because if they don't die, you have the locked-in syndrome. Fadi's working on a case right now where a gentleman is completely locked in. He can sense everything around him. He can't communicate appropriately, can't use his arms and legs, can't even open his eyes. And that's not uncommon because the coordination is messed up, so they can't purposely use their arms, so they have to rely on others for their most basic personal hygiene.
And is this a case where if quicker action had been taken, he might be doing better?
Sure. You know, we always say time is brain, and the sooner you treat this condition, you take the clot out or dissolve it, the sooner the blood flow is restored to the area and less tissue will be damaged then.
And don't trauma experts talk about the golden hour, that from the minute a stroke onsets, you really only have an hour or less to get effective treatment to that patient?
Right. The There's typically windows 3 hours,
three and a half hours,
6 hours, depending on the treatment. But universally, every treatment is less effective the longer a period of time passes from the onset of the stroke symptoms. We're very fortunate in Jacksonville. There are some really good comprehensive stroke care centers. Mayo Clinic is one of the leaders. Mm-hmm. And you should know which comprehensive center is closest to you so you can get there as quickly as possible. The delay is what really causes the problem.
Sure. And we've also got Trauma One. They obviously do great work at UF Health. So what's the main message you want to get out to people?
The main message is for everyone should recognize the stroke symptoms, seek immediate evaluation at an emergency room, and not a walk-in clinic. Usually going to a walk-in clinic could be a major waste of time.
Go to the ER if you even suspect the hint of one.
An emergency room is the best place to go.
Yeah, it's better to go too far to get care than not far enough.
That's true.
We'll have 911 take you, too. Don't drive.
Right. Very good advice from Matt Soule and Fadi Shakur, MD, both national leaders in stroke litigation from Jacksonville's Terrell Hogan firm. It's terrellhogan.com. As May marks Stroke Awareness Month, be aware of the signs and symptoms. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa, for having us.
In a moment, the Florida Theater celebrates its 90th birthday.
So one day I approached her after class, and I was like, Mrs. Brown, I am in love with Abby, and you have got to put me next to her. So Mrs. Brown says, I'll see what I can do.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live. No notes, no net. From the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, a Jacksonville icon recently celebrated its 90th anniversary. The Florida Theater first opened to the public on April 8th, 1927, as a movie palace. In that opening performance, the audience took in a live stage show that included an 18-piece orchestra, and then the main attraction, a two-reel silent film with musical accompaniment on a $100,000 Wurlitzer. Now, times have changed, but the Florida Theater's mission is the same nearly a century later, to serve as a beacon of amazing entertainment. Executive Director Numa Saiselin is here now with more about the last 90 years and the next. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And happy 90th anniversary.
It's not my 90th anniversary, but on behalf of the theater, thank you.
You know, I love the Florida Theater, and so many people do. I did not realize this, but there are really only two other theaters in the entire state that can even compare to our Florida Theater, this Art Deco era masterpiece. It is such a jewel for downtown Jacksonville, really.
So you're referring to the Olympia Theater in Miami and the Tampa Theater in Tampa, and we share an interior designer with the Tampa Theater. So if you walk inside the Tampa Theater, it's a little surreal because you think you're in the Florida Theater, and that's because they each had the same designer.
Very cool.
So when the Florida Theater was built, there were five other theaters on a four-block stretch of Forsyth Street. Mm-hmm. The Florida Theater was the sixth, and it's the only one left.
Isn't that sad to know? But at least one of them made it through.
I think that we would have had a little theater district there. But we're lucky that the Florida Theater survived. And interestingly, part of the reason for its survival is that it opened during the silent film era. Mm-hmm. So it has a stage that is a full stage with flies, and it's sizable enough to have live performance. It opened 6 months before The Jazz Singer came out. So it opened during the silent film era. With a silent film era stage. If it had opened just a year or two later, it would have had a stage that was too small to accommodate live performance, and it might not have survived, but it did. And we're lucky to have it now.
What a quirk of history. And of course, most of what you do at the Florida Theater is live. Incredible variety of live performances.
We have a little bit of film. We just announced our summer movie series the other day. But most of what we do is live performance. And our programming signature is to have a little bit of something for everybody. So just in the next couple weeks, we have performances by Julianne and Derek Hough from Dancing with the Stars, Ben Harper in The Innocent Criminals, George Thorogood, Todd Rundgren. And, you know, we go on through the summer and into the fall.
Sure. You also earlier this year announced Community First Credit Union is your partner, which is exciting.
Very exciting. It's terrific to have a local corporation as a season sponsor. We are a nonprofit organization. We earn, in a round number, 85% of our budget from business activities, and we have to fundraise the other 15%, which is a pretty good deal for the donors because mm-hmm. it's not a huge amount, and they help us, you know, cross that budget divide, and having a big season sponsor like Community First Credit Union is a big help.
And with a nearly 100-year-old building, maintenance can be a challenge. I didn't realize this, but you have to go through the business of updating the seats because people are bigger now than they were in 1927. That's upsetting and fascinating all at the same time. We're getting fat. You've got to redo the seats at the Florida Theater.
Well, the theater was built when the productions and the people were smaller.
Yeah.
So, yes, we have to maintain and upgrade the theater constantly.
Okay. And what are your thoughts about the opening of Daly's Place, which is right across the street here from WJCT? It's an outdoor amphitheater. Some acts will go there that you might have wanted in the past, but I would assume there's enough to go around for everybody.
So Jacksonville is a big city. It's a competitive market. It always has been. And every 10 years or so, something significant changes in the market. 10 years ago, it was the St. Augustine Amphitheater starting to do rock concerts. 10 years before that, it was the Times Union Center renovating. And, you know, here we are 10 years later, and it's Daly's Place. And it's clearly changing the landscape. And it's causing us to take a good look at ourselves and bring our A game every day mm-hmm. because the acts have suddenly started to move to buildings where we don't expect them to see. Mm-hmm. We don't expect to see them. And, you know, that causes us to really think, who are we and how are we going to compete? I think in the long term, once the dust settles, it'll be a terrific addition to the entertainment marketplace in Jacksonville. But for a couple of years, it's going to be really interesting to be me and my staff.
Sure. In the meantime, true icons love this venue because it's such a jewel. Can you tell the story of how Elvis Costello has bonded with you at the Florida Theater?
So last time we had Elvis in, he told the Times Union that the Florida Theater is one of his favorite venues anywhere in the world, which was a terrific thing to hear from an iconic performer. Just a few months after that, we had Mrs. Elvis Costello, also known as Diana Krall.
Right. Big fan of hers, too.
We had been booked the night they offered us a date, so we co-sponsored the show with the symphony, and we co-sponsored the show in Jacoby Hall. So that afternoon, Diana talked to Elvis on the phone, and she mentioned she was in Jacksonville that day. And Elvis said, of course, well, how do you like the Florida Theater? And she said, well, I'm not at the Florida Theater. And Elvis said, that's impossible. How could you be in Jacksonville? And he actually made her take a walk and go look at the theater. We're working very hard to bring her back this time to the Florida Theater.
Yeah, the grandeur of the place and the history is unlike any other performance space in town. It really is such a gem. It must be fun to go and work there every day.
Well, you know, we take it for granted a little bit because we're there every day.
Uh-huh.
And it's nice to be reminded of it from time to time by people like you or by Elvis and Diana, who really have a genuine love for the building and an appreciation of it.
One of the most exciting nights I had was when I played this tiny bit part in the HBO film Recount. And they shot that here in Jacksonville several years, you know, some time ago, over 10 years ago. Anyway, they had the premiere at the Florida Theater. And I remember walking in with my husband and friends to see this movie. And the tickets, they made the tickets in the form of hanging Chad ballots because that was the whole joke of the 2000 election. And everybody filed in to see this movie at the Florida Theater. And a lot of these people that came to see it were local Jacksonville people. And we had no idea if we were going to make it into the movie or not, or whether we'd, you know, be on the cutting room floor. And seeing that film in that theater after that production had been shot in Jacksonville, that was a real thrill. In that beautiful space, to see it there on the big screen. Pretty exciting.
Well, from time to time, we cross paths with performers who have grown up here and get to perform at the Florida Theater. And you can see it in their eye that it's just been this icon that's been part of their lives since they were born. And
Elvis performed there, and after all.
Yeah, and suddenly they're on the stage themselves. And it's really fun to be a part of that.
So, Numa, you mentioned the summer movie series. What else is coming up?
There's a full slate of shows. It's on floridatheater.com. That's our website that has our exclusive ticketing site on it. Ben Harper and the Innocent Criminals, George Thorogood, Todd Rundgren, The Happy Together Tour is back, Pure Prairie League, Firefall, Bring It Live.
You name it.
Yeah, there's a little something for everybody.
Go to floridatheater.com as they mark their 90th anniversary this year. Executive Director Numa Sasolin, congrats. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.